From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Deucing down in Dallas, Texas. And joining me in the wilds of Abbo Land, it is Mr. Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
You're a terrible man. Hello.
Sir. Yes, and also in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado, we have bass John Grace. Say hello, John.
Oh, yeah. Hello, everybody.
So this week, guys, we are continuing our discussion of all things Dirty Harry with the third film in the Dirty Harry franchise, The Enforcer, starring Clint Eastwood, directed by James Fargo, although James Fargo, quote-unquote, directed by Clint Eastwood,
yeah,
really, you know. Written by Sterling Siliphant, Dean Reisner, Gail Morgan Hickman, and S.W. Schur. And we also have Harry Guardino, Bradford Dillman, Tyne Daly, DeVarin Bookwalter. One of my favorite names in the cast is Albert Popwell.
Yes.
Mustafa.
Yes.
And you also have Dick Duroc in there as well.
Yes.
So, yeah. The Enforcer. This was actually, guys, my first time seeing this movie.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, I have not seen this one or Sudden Impact. I've never seen either one.
Wow, this was a staple on TV here late night. I mean, Clint Eastwood films, you know, especially the one was The Outlaw Josie Wales, The Enforcer was another one. If the cricket finished early or the football, you know, was done early, basically it's like, quick, let's get a Clint Eastwood Mel Paso title film on there. It's like, and throw one out there. So,
right.
Yeah, this is one of them.
Yeah. Yeah,
in the 1980s, this was one of the rare theatrical films that on network television, two networks had the broadcast rights to. So ABC and NBC would run it like every other month because it always got good ratings whenever they aired it. And I was wondering if maybe that's because they were able to get a decent TV version out of it that wasn't incomprehensible.
Yes.
Like, you know, they could trim the raw stuff and still run it, and it still made sense. I watched it a lot of times when I was a kid, and I didn't see the uncut version, I think, until Cinemax acquired it in the late 80s and was running it. And then later I saw it on Laserdisc, like in 94 or so. But and I was surprised how much was, you know, in there that I'd ever saw in the TV versions, because it was a pretty raunchy film.
Yeah, it's pretty violent for its day anyway.
Do you think it's more violent than Magnum Force?
No.
No, no, I don't think so. I was going to say Magnum Force is probably about the most brutal
like the scene
one.
The scene in the massage parlor, like that made almost no sense on the network TV version. Like he just walks to this room of old ladies. You didn't know why they were there.
You didn't have any of the blow up doll or anything like that.
Right. So it was edited and cut away in a certain way where it looked like he was just propositioning her for a massage, and then he grabs her by the throat or whatever, and then beats up the bouncer. But that scene was a lot shorter and played weirder. But like, you didn't see the chalkboard with the dirty letter that the old women are writing out.
Right.
You know, like it's their little mail. That was a big mail order thing back then.
Yeah. What was that? Explain that. Cause I was like, what kind of scheme is this?
It was like pornography back then was done through the mail.
Yeah.
And I think that was some sort of way to sell like 8mm loops and stuff. So,
okay.
I mean, I'm sure you could get somebody who's more smarter about those type of thing or those dealings in the 70s, but I think that's what it was, because it was like they were writing out a personal ad, you know.
Because you have all these old ladies kissing these letters.
Right, it's, and making it look personal.
It's like the equivalent of the phone sex line or something. Like, you know.
Right. I think there's an Aerosmith video where it's like a phone sex thing, and this guy's imagining all this stuff, and it's like an old fat lady just hangs up the phone.
Oh, yeah, that was the running joke all the time. You get this, you know, really sexy, attractive voice on the other end. It's just some, you know, 300-pound, you know, bloated 5'1" woman who's just, you know, got six kids
Sounds
running
good,
around or some know. Shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it? Did any of you ever see that terrible Spike Lee movie, Girl 6?
No.
Which terrible Spike Lee movie? They're all terrible, pretty much.
Most of them, I should say.
No, I never saw it. No, I didn't.
It's the one about the girl who like joins a phone sex line operation. It's a really awful movie. It has Quentin Tarantino as like a piggy casting director, like telling girls, "Yeah, take off your top," you know.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
So is Spike one of the women gone? Yo, Sal's famous. Sal's famous. No.
No, actually, it was the last movie of his that he acted in, as far as I know. I mean, I haven't seen anything he's done since 25th Hour.
He's
but I think
been blocking people like you on Twitter. He's down time.
Yeah. He's been blocking me on Twitter instead of acting. But yeah, I think it was the last movie he directed that he also acted in.
There's only been, I think, two Spike Lee movies I've enjoyed. Do the Right Thing. Although these days I look at it in a different light because it's obviously a precursor to the whole fucking Black Lives Matter movement. But one I really like a lot, I think it's probably my favorite one, is Clockers.
Which oh,
one
sure,
of
yeah.
Lesser known ones, which I thought was really good. I enjoyed that one.
I like 25th Hour. It's really good with Edward Norton.
I didn't like Summer of Sam. I thought that was stupid.
I never saw Summer of Sam.
Actually, that's the only one I like. I think all his other movies are bullshit.
Really? I thought it was Summer of
Sam. Just, they're
dumb.
They're black movies made for white liberals. Blacks don't go see his films.
No, they don't. I thought Mo Better Blues was all right.
I hated that one. Not that at all.
What was that first movie he made? She's
Gotta Have It.
She's Gotta Have It. That movie sucked. I couldn't sit through School Days. I couldn't get through it. No. But I liked 25th Hour is probably my favorite thing he's done that I've seen.
Okay. Did you say you've seen Clockers or not?
I haven't seen it. I have. It's been a while, but I remember liking it.
Yeah, it was really good. I enjoyed Harvey Keitel and Delroy Lindo.
That was supposed to be a Scorsese film, and I think he passed it off to Spike or something.
That would make sense. It smacks a Scorsese all over it. When you watch it, you think, wow, it's not really a Spike Lee movie. But,
25th Hour feels that way, too.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a good one. But The Enforcer. So this was my first time seeing it, and I got to say, I really enjoyed it. It's very much back to the Dirty Harry, the anti-PC cop that you see in the first movie. Like I thought Magnum Force, as much as I like it, is a bit of an apology for the first movie.
It is,
because it's so like, oh, now the cops are the ones acting like fascists, like they dress like Nazis and, you know, go out in these death squads that and kill people, and I kind of, and Harry has to go up against them, you know, and this movie,
well, I always, you know, thought that I always thought that Magnum Force borrowed a little bit from THX-1138, especially the way the police looked. Not so much.
Oh yeah,
the story.
They definitely look like the cops.
Yeah, a lot.
They've got the button-down leather jackets with the bike helmets.
Yeah.
But the Enforcer has Clint as, you know, the guy going up against the system. You know, he's constantly being like, you know, it's in San Francisco and everybody's trying to be PC, like putting women on the force and stuff. And was it one of my favorite bits was when they go to see Mustafa and you know, Mustafa will only talk to Harry. He won't talk to his female partner. And
I wonder if they run to the Nation of Islam.
He's like, you know, she has to stay out here. And the guys in the lobby are like, or the barbershop are like, oh, we're going to take real good care of her. And Harry goes, oh, how white of you. I was like, oh my gosh, you would never see that in a movie today.
No, not at all. You would not. Well, like Clint may do it these days because he just doesn't give a fuck what people think. He does what he wants because, yeah. Well, he's got Emperor Clint Eastwood, so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he don't. Clint doesn't care.
He doesn't care because he's like 80-something now, and number two, he just doesn't care. Yeah.
He can still make movies even though, you know, he goes and yells at a chair, and that's supposed to be Barack Obama or something.
He's the best, mate.
Yeah, the interesting thing is The Enforcer was the most successful Dirty Harry film at the time.
I believe it.
Huge hit.
I mean, it was
globally a massive hit.
And, of course, critics hated it.
Oh, yeah, they hate him. So, yeah.
He's a fascist.
No, they didn't. They didn't start liking him until the French started praising him.
Yeah,
and then Pauline Kael died, and then they all could start, quit pretending that they didn't enjoy his movies.
All the Paulettes kind of went, oh,
yeah, all those weirdos. It's like I don't know why you would consider yourself a disciple of a hack writer. I mean, she's a good writer. But
I was about to say Pauline Kael's a good writer.
She wrote a lot of garbage though. Like, she wrote these rave reviews of Club Paradise. And some of these other dumb films. It's
and she was very
what on
like,
earth?
When did you hear Paul Schrader's interview with Bret Easton Ellis?
No.
They talked a lot about, and I know Paul Schrader's, he's gone full blown like kill Trump on Facebook, and I'm not really a fan of his, but he was one of the Paulettes, right?
Right.
And he kind of ran afoul of her, and so she kind of kicked him out. But he would talk about how she would get them together and say, okay, we're going to support this movie. And she would kind of tell all the film critics how to roll. And if they, didn't go with her, she'd cut them out.
Of course.
So.
Yeah, she's weird. She worked for the studios. She's completely compromised. Like Warren Beatty got her hired or something.
Oh, yeah, like for that, who's the guy who did Fingers?
Oh, Toback.
Toback. James Toback. She was going to do Love and Money, which is the worst. That and Playing for Keeps are like the worst film titles ever. Like, but for Love and Money, Beatty got her to produce it. But it was just to like play off her ego and to humiliate her. Like, that's all it was.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, but no, I never. Her hatred of Clint Eastwood was like really famous, and I guess there's a thing in the IMDb trivia about how Eastwood would take her reviews to a psychiatrist, and he said, "Oh, she's got like an insane crush on you. That's the problem."
No, of course, of course. No,
she just can't have.
No, I mean that's totally it, because she would say that Clint and actors like him reminded her of men she didn't like growing up.
Yeah,
and they're men she didn't like growing up, not because they were mean to her, but because they didn't pay attention to her.
Exactly.
These were the Chads of the neighborhood.
Right. So she hated Steve McQueen. She hated Kevin Costner. She really despised him.
Yeah, they were the Chads that she longed for, that spurned her. And, she went and, she had kids with – she was famous for, like, dating homosexuals,
Right.
Homosexual men or homosexual women?
Homosexual men.
Why would you waste your time? Why is it?
Well, I think it was one of those things. Yeah, I think it's one of those things where she didn't really like. She would go after men like that. Like, she had a kid with a homosexual poet or something. I think he was a poet, but her daughter was. Yeah, these were guys who were unavailable because they were gay, and they were looking for a beard or something, and
she was miserable.
No, yeah, I mean, those were the guys that would date her, And, Pauline Kael was not an attractive woman, at all.
Probably Clint said to her, on the side, "You're ugly and your kid's the daughter of a fag."
Yeah, well, also, this is the Dirty Harry movie with, like, the, with him, saying fucking fruit. Like in the finale before he blows up the villain, who is implied that he's gay or whatever. Or,
well, yeah, they're this like weird. They're this weird like left wing group.
Right, right. It's played by Devrin Bookwalter, and I looked him up, and he died young in 87. So you know what that could mean. But his debut was Andy Warhol's Blowjob, where he's getting blown by another dude.
Oh, well, there you go.
One of the Warhol films. And he also did a gay porn film the following year after doing this.
Well, there you go.
Called Manhole. So there you go. And then, but then he got married, had a kid, but died of stomach cancer in 1987 or something.
Yeah. Isn't stomach cancer usually the...
Yeah.
Yeah, if your stomach's in your ass, no worries.
Oh, my God.
Give me a fucking break.
Yeah, so, but yeah, the movie, I remember Pauline Kael was really pissed because Harry saying fucking fruit and blowing him up with a bazooka.
Yeah, and actually, one thing about the movie, I was kind of thinking, okay, maybe it's going to go a little PC here, was you have you know, he gets this partner played by Tyne Daly.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you know, Harry's new partner. And I was sitting there thinking, Harry's partners always die.
Right.
I'll bet this one is not. And they're going to have her be like the heroic female character. Nope. But I was kind of expecting a Mary Sue. But instead, she's actually very like trepidate. Like when she has to use violence, you know, she has a hard time handling it.
Yeah.
And she is killed. Yep. In the finale of the film, and I was like, "Whoa, that would never happen today."
And there's that deleted scene of Clint leaning over when she's dead, going, "You shouldn't have married a black man in real life, Tyne."
Oh my god, Stuart, are you just trying to make the editing for me hard?
Yeah, it's like she's a doomed character. It's like you could tell she's dead from the get go because that is a tradition. His partners get stabbed, shot, wounded, dead. You know. Because you're talking a hard R action film too, so yeah, she's gonna die.
Yeah,
pretty much.
And I was just thinking about like all the movies I see now with like, you know, Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and stuff where, you know, the female characters are invincible and never encounter any hardship whatsoever. You know,
like, right? Oh god, The Force Awakens where she automatically can duel with this Kylo Ren character.
I know. I thought that's ridiculous.
No training at all.
Yeah, she's she just magically knows how to, you know, sword fight. Never had a lesson fencing. Luke Skywalker in The Empire Strikes Back, he can't even make it through. You know, yeah. Vader makes mincemeat out of him.
Right. You know? Kicks his ass.
Do we have to talk about Star Wars, please?
Well, I'm just saying. Well,
yeah,
I've
got
talking,
it.
Like, I'm talking tired. About, like, contemporary.
I'm tired to the fucking retina of that shit.
I know, but I'm giving a contemporary example with a, you know, old example. Whereas a female character like the Kate Moore character in The Enforcer would never be allowed to exist today, you know,
right.
In a mainstream film.
He never had Sandra Locke killed off in any of his movies. Not that I remember anyway, did he?
He should have.
He should have, yeah. He should
you
have
know,
had
you know why? Because she ain't giving nothing up. If she dies in Clint's movies, like, I'll spare you.
I remember my grandmother hated Sandra Locke, and like Clint Eastwood went down in her opinion because
he was. Is that the grandmother with the gun rack?
No. This is my dad's mom.
Oh, okay, the other one.
She's not the only one because that was the most common complaint I heard growing up was his movies took a dive in quality when he kept putting Sandra Locke in everything.
I liked her.
Yeah, I don't care for her, so it's like I kind of saw what people were talking about.
Yeah,
I'm glad you enjoyed your 4 years here, John. Saying that.
But it's like, no, it's just it gave the movies a same quality. Like you would see the same scenes in every movie. He'd always save her from a gang rape. He would save her from some assault. There would be some scene where she would do something to piss him off. You know, every which way but loose where he's hung up on her and she's just awful to him.
Oh, yeah. She's just like shit. Every which way but loose is like I was like, what's Clint doing in this movie?
Oh, he's totally emasculated.
You know,
that
was
one.
His biggest hit.
Yeah.
That was his biggest hit.
Because I was sick of seeing him always being this macho figure. I just wanted to see a different side of Clint and they got it with that. You know, that's why they had him with the monkey and, you know, completely emasculated. And but he's basically he's like cucky in that movie.
Yeah, well, it's just like, I don't know. But Eastwood put her down going, oh, she and her gay friend were always talking, calling each other Hobbit and shit. So,
did he really say that?
Yes, he said that in a Playboy interview in the 90s.
Dude, what is it with Playboy interviews? Like, all they seem to do is get in trouble. Like,
it's almost like a joke. It's like, okay, I'm going to do a Playboy interview because everybody reads the articles like they say they do. I've never got that.
Well, it's like Jimmy Carter. His presidency is remembered as lust in his heart. You know, like, was it recently Gary Oldman did an interview with him and he said, like, you know, he said he got in all this trouble from, like, every angle. He, like, offended leftists and right-wingers, you know?
He called Nancy Pelosi a cunt. But he did it theoretically. If I call her a cunt, I will get in trouble. And he got in trouble.
Who, Jimmy Carter?
And he also said, no, this was this was Gary Oldman.
Oh, Gary Oldman. I was going to say, if Jimmy Carter said it, that would be fucking awesome.
He also said, fuck the Pope.
Oh, boy. Maybe you got that Nuclear Assault song title mixed up. I meant to say.
Yeah, it could be. Could be.
So it's safe to say that Gary Oldman's one of us, and is he?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
That's very
cool. He totally is.
That is very cool.
I worked on a movie with a movie by some people who did The Contender.
Okay.
And they really hated him. And it was because he was very upset with how The Contender made his character look, because he played a Republican senator in the movie.
Right.
And apparently Gary Oldman complained that his character was portrayed more fairly in the movie, and the movie makes him look like a complete psycho. And he apparently was very angry with how it turned out, because I think he didn't agree with it politically.
Yeah, going around that he had those viewpoints, though, that he was right wing or right, whatever it would be in England, I guess.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It'd be the Tories over in England, the Tory Party.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I had heard that sort of stuff before, and I'd mentioned it to other people who lean left. Go, oh, that wouldn't surprise me at all with him. You know, so it's like, I guess he's always come off that way in interviews or something.
Yeah.
Or the read between the lines.
And you know, he was in a lot of Luc Besson films, and I've heard Luc Besson's kind of a little based. I don't know if you watch like his movies.
I think he is, because when the whole Polanski thing was going on, all these filmmakers were like signing that thing to free Polanski and
Guillermo del Toro. Polanski. Oh.
Yeah, and then Luc Besson was like, he's a friend of mine, but he needs to go to prison. I mean, it's the weirdest thing. It's like, he's a friend of mine, I know him, but he needs to go serve his time.
Yeah,
he
committed a crime, he needs to go away.
We need to change his name to Luc Besson.
I don't know, I'm really looking forward to Valerian, so maybe that'll be a whole big woke film for the
Well, and like, you know, you watch like From Paris with Love or Taken, you know.
Unknown to the actors, they're actually like these completely anti-Muslim movies.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Because I had somebody like tell me, "Oh, well, no, they're said to be Muslim in Taken." I go, "Yeah, but they have that crescent and star tattoo that a Muslim would have, like on all the bad." It's like, please.
Oh, those are all movies that make Europe look like a very dangerous place to go. Please, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like, everybody I know is
apparently like, very true.
It's like, my daughter's going to study abroad. I'm going to short Taken. You know?
Yeah. From Paris to Love. That was a fucking kick-ass film, that one.
Yeah, I love that movie.
So awesome. And Taken as well. Yeah. That first one, the second and the third.
I didn't see any of the sequels. I heard, don't bother.
Two was all right.
I couldn't get past 10 minutes in them.
Three was not good at all.
But The Enforcer, so...
Not about Rodrigo Duterte, by the way.
No.
If they remade it would be.
It should be.
It would have to be.
Did anybody get an Italian crime movie vibe off this movie?
A little bit.
Well, I mean, they were using the Dirty Harry movies as a visual template for them to work from, so.
Yeah, because I felt like I was watching a Eurocrime thing. Like, yeah. The music and the dialogue and everything, it felt very...
A lot of long shots as well.
Very Italian,
yeah.
You know,
right? And I guarantee nobody on The Enforcer even watched those, or even cared. You know, it's just the Italians were using the Dirty Harry films, and I think The French Connection, and probably Seven Ups and Serpico for sure, were used to sort of like these visual templates to work off of. Like
totally.
You know, haven't seen a lot of those. They. It's always, there's always a callback to one of those films. You know, it's always, okay, that's a Dirty Harry, or okay, that's Serpico. You know, it's like, there's always stuff in there.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't thinking that this movie was influenced by those, but I was thinking, okay, this is kind of where we're getting that vibe from. This feels like the nucleus for a lot of Eurocrime stuff I've seen, especially the Italian stuff.
Right. And also San Francisco was a really crazy city in the 70s. And they did actually have the Black Radical groups and the SLA army or whatever the hell they were, you know, the terrorist groups that this is based on. And they had all that kooky shit going on back then. People don't think about San Francisco like that anymore, which is odd because in the 70s, that was like the crazy city.
No, yeah, it's now it's like a, you know, tech oligarchy or something.
Right. Now it's just this uppity left-wing yuppie you know, overpriced city, but back in the 70s it was like crazy land. I mean, it was crazy. Like that whole the Harvey Milk shooting and George Roscoe and the mayor of San Francisco.
The Twinkie murder.
Yep. Yeah, everybody thinks that, what's his name, Dan White killed them because he's homophobic.
No.
Yeah, it wasn't because he was homophobic. He was psycho. And the reason he was given the Twinkie defense worked, it wasn't because of the homophobia of the jury. It's because everybody in the jury, Californians, believed anything a psychiatrist told them.
Yeah, he just went, he ate a bunch of sugar and his levels.
Yeah, man. This therapist says that. Okay. That's what that whole case was about.
Moscone was straight. He killed him. So, the whole defense, yeah. Hey, got him off.
Right, and if you watch there's a comedy from 1980 that is a famous flop, and a friend of mine is working on the official book on this movie, Serial, with Martin Mull and Tuesday Weld. It's all about how the Bay Area was nuts back then. And the movie did very well in flyover country, but flopped on the coast because it was perceived as making fun of those, you know, the upper class areas of the Bay Area. But in flyover country, it was like, well, all those Californians are fruitcakes, and this movie is accurate.
That was a cash joke.
It's a very good film. If you find it's on Blu-ray, like it's well worth seeing. But Serial. But the funny thing is, what was funny about Serial back then, it now looks like a documentary. It's not even funny. Like all this stuff is mainstream now. Like right. There's jokes about organic grocery stores and stuff.
Oh, it's
like,
very Swipple.
Yeah, now that's totally normal. Whole Foods and those type of places. It's like, but back then that was seen as bizarre. And but San Francisco is a nutty city. So you have, and it's kind of, it's close together. You can walk around the city pretty easily. So it's got that kind of teeming metropolis vibe to it or whatever. So it's a perfect setting for this type of movie. And there's something I realized watching it. I think this is Ronan Rowe had told me that the opening murder scene was a big influence on John Carpenter when he was making Halloween. Because you'll notice that the head terrorist walks out in the background, like while the guy's looking over the cliff, like he's in the background shot. And this is a shot that I never could appreciate on television because he was cropped out. But he kind of pops up in the corner like Michael Myers would, and there's a somewhat of a point of view of him walking up stabbing the guy in the back, and that was an inspiration on Carpenter. But I realized watching this film, I think it inspired Carpenter to write Escape from New York.
Yeah, I was going to say,
think
like,
about it. Yeah, radical group kidnaps a president, except in Escape from New York, they take him to Manhattan, which is the new Alcatraz. But in this one, they take the heir to Alcatraz and hold them hostage, and
and another thing that, because a lot of those Euro movies are inspired by Carpenter movies, like the gang in this movie is very colorful. Like it almost feels like Bronx Warriors or something.
Yeah. and what is Dick Durock doing there? He doesn't look like a hippie.
You know?
We just needed a stunt guy who could do a good stunt, you know. But I think this movie was a favorite of Carpenter's. Like, he loved the Dirty Harry movies, and I really think this inspired Escape from New York because it has that kind of weird gang, and the plotting and everything is very,
and the
very
tough guy lead character who like doesn't give a shit, you know?
Right. Yeah, Carpenter had actually said he would love to have directed a Dirty Harry film, but I think Clint liked doing those things so cheap that he would never he wouldn't work with any known talent.
No.
You know? Yeah,
plus,
and Clint, this was
Clint's
a cheap
very
film.
Quick. Clint's quick. He likes to do a couple of takes. That's it. Done. And I don't know what Carpenter's style is. I don't know how many takes he does. I think he's pretty quick as well. But he could never put his hands, his films into the hands of someone who's going to do take after take after take. Clint's like, oh, it's done. I'm bored of it. Let's go.
Right. Eastwood didn't seem to want to collaborate with like big directors through the decades after he was done with the Leon films.
No, he kind of liked people he could control.
Right.
Like, I mean, James Farr, like, you know, you have your – what's the guy who did Deadpool?
Buddy Van Horn.
Buddy Van Horn. Mm. Like there were names when you saw directing a Clint Eastwood movie, you went, okay, Clint Eastwood's the de facto director. This guy is just
right. Buddy Van Horn is doing all of his stunts in The Enforcer. He was Eastwood's stunt double.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there you go. Yeah.
But Fargo had talked about he had worked as an associate. I listened to the commentary, and he said he had worked as associate producer. And he said Clint liked to promote from within. That's just the way he did things. And he was an associate producer, and Eastwood just pulled him into an office and said, so you're going to be directing this film, and you know, you start planning for it. What do you want to do for it, and all that? And it was like, huh? And it's like he was just one of those guys that he believed in building up, and he said he directed almost any scene you don't see Eastwood. He goes, Eastwood wasn't even in San Francisco when he was shooting most of the film without the non-Dirty Harry scenes. He says because Eastwood was off flying off to meetings and everything. He was working on like two or three films at once. And this was sort of like the cheap production that would make all the money for Warner Brothers. So then he had a deal with Warner Brothers where he would give him a Dirty Harry. It would make a lot of money. It wouldn't cost anything. Then they let him do a personal picture like Bronco Billy or
Pink Cadillac.
Yeah, Pink Cadillac. Something where he could do something weird that he figured was probably going to flop anyway.
Or a White Honda Black Heart, which I really like a lot.
Right. And those movies would usually not make much money. And then Unforgiven, interesting enough, was one of those films. It wasn't supposed to be a giant hit. And then he would go give him a Dirty Harry or whatever, or Gauntlet, and that would make money. And he could go back and do what he wanted. But and I don't think anybody has a deal like that today. I can't think of any actor.
Oh, well, what about Guillermo del Toro? There. He does Hellboy, and then he does Pan's Labyrinth, you know?
Yes, with a completely different set of producers.
I know, right? What about Steven Soderbergh? You know, he does Ocean's 13, and then he does
I would say those are probably, you know, make it for the studio. It's supposed to make money. I don't know if they do make money. And then he gets to do like The Girlfriend Experience or Haywire or something weird. But with The Enforcer, you've got, you know, it was pretty much I don't even think they thought it was going to be the monster hit that it was. It was just that the character was catching on and transcending culture because it was, you know, this was huge in Italy. This movie was a big hit in Italy. In fact, when I posted the soundtrack on Facebook Friday night, one of my Italian friends was like, hey, I have this CD. You know, he loves this stuff. He runs
right
like
there next to their Genesis albums. And
yeah, Andrea Mazzacchetti, he runs like a Paul Schrader page, interesting enough, on Facebook. And he was like, hey, I have this soundtrack. So, but yeah, a lot of the, it was huge in Italy, and you could see its inspiration in Castellari movies and Franco Nero films and Maurizio Merli and all those guys. And it was, you know, it was like this script that like two high school kids basically left at his restaurant.
Really?
Yeah. Gail Morgan Hickman and who's the other writer?
SJSW Sure.
Yeah. It's like they were young kids. They were just like film nerds who they might have been in their first couple of years in college or whatever, but they didn't know how to get an agent to send a script to him. So they just left it at the Hogs Breast Saloon and Carmel by the Sea or wherever it is. So it was, and he liked the idea enough where they had Sterling Silliphant do three different drafts, and Eastwood didn't like any of those, so he had brought one of the original Dirty Harry writers back to finish it, and who was Dean Reiser, I think, and Dean Reiser wrote the stuff with the Black Militant group and that whole scene. Like, that was his whole thing.
That's some of the movie.
the Silliphant script that was rejected would have involved Chinatown gangs. And he had Harry with a female Chinese partner who did, I guess, some kung fu or whatever. I think he was trying to gear up a part for his wife, Tiana. And Eastwood just didn't think that was where he wanted to go. He wanted something, you know, a little more down to earth.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, but yeah. I did think it was interesting that they had a complete. Yeah, it was Gail Morgan Hickman and S.W. Sure. And Hickman went on to write a lot of movies. I don't think wrote anything. But they go back and they get the original, one of the original screenwriters, to basically give it a huge rewrite just to make sure it's in with their universe and it's perfect. You know?
Well, I will say my favorite line in this whole film is when Clint's talking to that guy. I think it's Clint. I watched this very early this morning, so I'm a bit lost. And that black guy goes, yeah, you're welcome here, but it's welcome as a turd in a punch bowl.
I thought it was turd in a swimming pool.
Oh, turd in a swimming pool.
Yeah, it was turd in a swimming pool.
Oh, turd in a swimming pool.
Yeah, it's the same joke, basically.
Same. Like, I watched this, boys, I watched this about 6:30 this morning. I got up very early and I popped it on. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, another end joke in is when Eastwood goes to the massage parlor. He says his name is, I think it's Bud Dickman or something. And that was a joke out of a Don Rickles routine.
Was it really?
It's a name. Right? Yeah, it was an in joke. It was a nod to Don Rickles because Eastwood worked with him on Kelly's Heroes and was a fan of his comedy. And so that was Eastwood. Like, he wanted that scene in there so he could do that character. And I guess he did a similar persona in the Iger Sanction, and which I haven't seen that movie in years, but I guess he does a similar character posing as a delivery.
Yeah, that was big hit with my brother, the Iger Sanction. He loves that film for some reason.
But yeah, some people do. I don't remember loving it too much, but it's a weird film.
Yeah, it's all right. I think I prefer...
By the way, if Clint Eastwood walked into a massage parlor, how would you not think he was a cop, you know?
Well, that's why he's got the hat that's too small for his head.
Yeah, I mean, like, what's his name? I remember listening to Loveline, and Mike Catherwood said that he would, like, try to go to massage parlors to get, like, a handy, and he said that he never got one, and it was because he looks like a cop. And when you look at Mike Catherwood, you're like, yeah, he does look like a cop.
Well, that's like Jay Morid said when he was filming Street Kings, that he grew like a cop mustache, and he was huge from lifting weights, and he had like kind of emulated the way cops walk and talk and everything. So he's, but so while he stopped at a McDonald's like in the hood in St. Louis while he was on tour or something, and he still had that look, and like everybody was real quiet. And, you know, is it all black McDonald's or whatever? Everybody was incredibly quiet and respectful, and he didn't know why. And then he realized because he looked like a cop.
Well, that's what
you get drop the place.
They thought that William Friedkin was a cop as well when he was out with the cops during the French Connection pre-production, because he was going to all these drug busts. They thought he was a detective as well, yeah. Which is like,
which hard to imagine. It's like, jeez,
yeah.
With his gigantic owl glasses and everything. But yeah, Tyne Daly's performance, it's like, in a way, she was like, she beat out other applicants for the role because her readings were just dead on, according to Fargo. And I don't know, she's not very appealing. That's the problem. She's not as an actress. It's like, you don't like looking at her, you don't want to listen to her, but she does nail the role, but she just doesn't. She kind of makes rewatching this film a bit of a like, ugh, she's grating. Like, I can't stand her. It's like she's sort of that drawback. Yeah, it's tough to take. I overall like the movie, but and it's like it's hard to argue with her casting because the thing was a monster hit. But
and it got her Cagney and Lacey as well.
Yeah, it did. It sure did. Mm. And but yeah, I can't stand her. So it's kind of even though she nails it, like when she's super nervous after she shoots the nun with the terrorist disguised as a nun, like in the back and everything. Like, yeah, that's a really strong scene. And that's just, it's like, yeah, it's like you can see why she got the role, but it's just her personality and everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't have a problem with her because I felt she was kind of believable. And yeah. I thought her character was going to be a really PC sort of, I thought that was going to be kind of the thing to make the, you know, the lefty critics okay with the movie, but it turned out that wasn't the case. But I thought she was pretty believable in the role. I didn't really have a problem with her. I thought what the movie did with her, I mean, viewing it through today's lens is unexpected. But, you know, it's of course I'm going to say that. Anybody who listens to the show knows I'm going to say that if they've seen the movie. Mm. You know.
Right. Yeah. Right. And another thing was Fargo had said that most of the, aside from the leads, most of the supporting roles, they cast local San Francisco actors.
Did they
like
really?
Michael Cavanaugh later Yeah, like Michael Cavanaugh came in, and I guess he was working in San Francisco or whatever, and he was from New York, but you know, he became a very regular bit player on television and movies after this film. But yeah, everybody was like a San Francisco local because they felt like they should give work to the actors in San Francisco and also give it that flavor, you know, because a Southern Californian and a Northern California back then, it was like two different states, really.
Well, and that was my job when I worked at the Film Commission in Memphis, was to get as many local people hired as possible, but even on the cast, you know, wanted them to hire as many local people as possible. And, you know, whenever Craig Brewer did a movie, there were tons of local actors in those movies.
Was there a criteria you had to meet with the local film? Like, you've got to have, say, 60% locals working on the set?
No, you didn't, because the incentive stated that you would get a percentage back based on your local hire. So it was just in your interest to hire more locally because it meant you were going to be getting more money back from the government. So,
okay.
You know, whereas like if you were shooting a movie in Louisiana at the time, I don't know what their laws are now, but like Benjamin Button, that Fincher's film, they shot that in Louisiana, and they got incentivized on everything. Like, it didn't matter if you were from Louisiana or not. Like, Brad Pitt's salary got incentivized. So they would incentivize the total budget. Whereas in Tennessee, and, you know, this is the way it should be for film incentives, it was you just get incentivized on your local hires. Because and, you know, that makes sense because, you know, you're trying to grow the local economy. You're not doing that if you're importing talent.
I was going to ask, did they do that to sort of combat the Canadian tax shelter that was going on over the up north?
I think it was just to draw people to the area. Like, if you're making a movie in the South and you want that flavor, we want you to make it here. But Tennessee didn't want to allocate the funds to get competitive with Louisiana and Georgia because Louisiana and Georgia were incentivizing much more than local talent. So that's why you had Memphis Beat shooting in Louisiana.
Well, Steven Seagal, lawman, didn't do much to help New Orleans.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Where mama at? Where mama at?
We got to do one or two episodes of those one day.
We got to do funny. Something.
Oh, God.
Anything else you guys want to bring up about The Enforcer? I mean, for me, it was just a sort of middling picture. Was there. It was okay. Again, like I said, I watched it at the wrong hour, but I needed to get it in before because I've been watching other stuff, which I probably shouldn't have, like Alien 3.
Wait, yeah. We need to do.
Well, there's a ton of in jokes. There's a couple of in jokes. Did you catch that the pimp in the massage parlor was named Baczynski?
Yeah, after Bronson,
which is Charles Bronson's real name. And then one of the terrorists was named Lalo after Lalo Schifrin.
Schifrin, yeah. So,
there were a couple of little funny nods in there to people that Eastwood had worked with or knew. And I mean, there's some fun stuff in there, but it doesn't call attention to it like if it were a John Landis movie.
No, it's not like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where they, you know, deliberately called this ape Maurice, and oh god, that was just hideous.
Where it's like they really show it off, you know.
Yeah,
it's one of those things. If you're in the know, you'll catch it, you know.
Right. Yeah, because these were made for flyover country. These were made for working class audiences. These are not made for cosmopolitan audiences in the city. You know, like all movies today are either made for 12-year-old kids or, you know,
or they're made
upper class snobs.
Or they're made for adults who've got the mentality of a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah, yes. You know, yeah, model. Yeah, 40-year-olds in the toy section at Target. You know.
But I got to say that the city of San Francisco looks absolutely beautiful. I have been there, but of course I've only been stuck in the airport there for about 45 minutes. I never got to see the outside. But
I've never been to San Francisco. I've been to LA, but
LA didn't really enthrall me a great deal. What I saw
didn't enthrall me either.
No, nothing like.
I hate Los Angeles.
It didn't do much for me at all. I got that vibe when I was there. It's like, I'm not liking this place at all. Apart from that Taco Bell, that was kick-ass.
That's awful.
And that little black kid who worked there. Well, not little, but that teenage black kid who gave me all those cool tacos. San Francisco, I want to see. It just looks like a place that, it's always, like the scenery, like from Bullet to Dirty Harry to other films.
Zodiac.
Zodiac as well. It's always looked like a really, really nice city. One that I would like to see sometime in the near future. Perhaps when I set up that big Vegas thing for the MMC to do a week in Vegas.
Yes.
I don't know how far San Francisco is from there.
It's pretty far.
Oh, well, okay. That's going off the
cards. It's a plane flight away.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not a drive?
Yeah.
No.
No?
No. Oh,
that sucks.
Like LA is, maybe, but...
Yeah.
Okay, I'm stunned just how big your country is, and the fact that you got to get someplace. People travel 6 hours to go to a rock concert. I'm like, what the fuck? That's like from here to Canberra away. I wouldn't drive to fucking Canberra to go see a rock band. I don't care who they are.
I wouldn't do that anymore. So I was willing to do that in my youth.
When I was younger, I drove to Chicago to see Iron Maiden from Memphis. That was a haul.
Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a I hope you got to hang out backstage with Eddie for that shit. What's that, about an 8-hour drive? I'm just guessing here. Is that 8 hours?
It was about that. We had really good seats, though, so.
You'd fucking want to for an 8-hour drive. You wouldn't want to have the nosebleeds, that's for sure.
No, yeah, we had really good spots, so it was nice.
Hmm. Yeah, I just always think 6 hours, that's from here to Canberra. No. 8 hours, that's here to Sydney. No, I'm not driving there. Bugger that. Well, anything else you guys want to bring up about this?
I think that about does it for me. I enjoyed it overall. Like, I thought it was a pretty breezy watch. Good junk food. Out of 10, I'd give it about a 7. I'd give it 7 knives to the back.
7? Well, that's not bad. I'm going to go a bit lower and give it about 6 turn the swimming pools out of 10.
Very nice.
Yeah, I'd give it about maybe 7 marvelous one-liners, because that was apparently, they were making that his big one line in this movie.
There is a lot of marvelous. There is a lot of one-liners.
He says it a few times. They were trying to turn that into the one-liner for the movie. It didn't quite work. And Fargo says on the commentary it didn't work.
No.
Yeah, so it's like, but I mean, these, you know, it is what it is. It's like, a lot of it is seeing a movie that I watched a lot of times in childhood, but haven't seen in 24 years. So it's kind of like, it's that weird vibe, you know, it's like you're looking at something that you would live for the screenings on TV because we didn't have VCRs. So it's like, you want to see an action movie. Oh, The Enforcer's on, you know, and you knew the shots by heart of the opening robbery scene and everything with them. Eastwood, like Harry shooting him in the back or whatever, where the guy's running up the stairs.
Or Harry doing the autopsy. Harry the autopsy. And someone says, eat Luigi's.
yeah, that I remember that scene being on the TV print, so yeah. A lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's cool enough. And it's also interesting that it's an action movie from a time when action heroes weren't portrayed like they are in the Schwarzenegger movie Commando, where they're standing in the middle of a backyard, open sight, just mowing down 20 or 40 guys running at them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like that became the superhero, invincible Rambo type of hero. Kind of became the staple.
You know, 10,000 bullets fired him, not one of them hits him. I'm like, give me a break.
Yeah,
right. Not happening. This dates back to a more believable, you know, action scenes and combat tactics, and Harry, you know, jumping to the rooftop chase, which is pretty cool, and good score in this movie too. And
yeah, it was a good score. Like,
yeah, and it's got a lot of things you don't see in action films at all today. It'd be nice if somebody would try to make them like this again, so where I don't have to take Dramamine before I go to a theater, or
that is
anti-nausea medicine.
That is a lost art. The musical score these days of film is nothing.
Yeah, Jerry Fielding did the score for this one.
Mm-hmm. It's a good score, too.
Yeah, but there's, you know, those Lalo Schifrin scores of the 70s, those days are gone. You'll never.
Yeah, all scores are just pure atmosphere, unless you got like a Hans Zimmer or something. You might get something memorable, but.
Yeah.
You basically, it's like the deadlift, too, from Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
You know,
I think the last best score I heard Hans Zimmer do was the Dark Knight. I did like that score.
Yeah,
film was okay. The score was good, though.
I liked his scores for Nolan's Batman movies.
Yeah,
those were good.
Yeah,
those are good scores.
But if you did this score these days, say like a Lalo Schifrin, you know, that jazzy, what do they call it? What'd you call it, John? That not neo jazz is not the term. What was it called?
Gosh, I don't know.
You mentioned it somewhere. Like that score he did, like that album he did with Dizzy Gillespie. If he had a score like that. I think we mentioned it before in the past.
Yeah, like a kind of, it's like a fusion jazz or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it would be great. Like, I listened to the Miles Davis Electric Period albums, like Dark Magus, and I'm like, that would be a great film score. Like, I'm just listening to it, and it's just got the perfect film score sound.
You know how I thought
about?
Yeah, go on, John. Sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to say, with that Dizzy Gillespie stuff, the Lalo Schifrin, you know who I thought, I want to ask him if he's ever used it for his show's Scheme, if he's ever grabbed that music and used it somewhere along the way, or if he even knows about it.
Oh, he might have. I'm sure he knows about
him or
it.
Paul. You know, if you've ever used that sort of music, that's right up there, alley.
Yeah, it is completely. Like, it's that's a great album.
I'd like to see what sort of remix, like, what spin they could put on it. You know, just do a.
Oh shit! It'd be mind blowing. It's like, because that's great stuff, but it's also the type of music I don't know if people would appreciate in a movie today. But then again, that film Drive came out that had the synth score, and that was unique, you know, for a current film, and people went nuts for that.
Is that the Ryan Gosling film?
You don't see
film?
Anybody really try.
Drive?
Yeah, the Gosling movie.
Good movie,
it has, yeah, it has a, yeah, it has a good synth score, and people were going nuts for that score.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe people would try having these John Carpenter type synth scores again, but nobody does.
Well, there's a few, but they're all independent. Like It Follows had one.
Oh, okay.
And that,
yeah, I couldn't get through that movie.
It had a score that sold pretty well. As far among that audience, I should say, not like as right. far as film scores go, like the synth wave audience was into that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they got one of those artists to do the music for it.
Yeah, it's just like back in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't unusual for Tangerine Dream or one of these groups to.
Right, totally.
And nowadays, it's like it all sounds like David Arnold or Hans Zimmer reject music or something. You know,
yeah.
It's very canned and generic.
I mean, gone are the days of, yeah, like you said, with the Tangerine Dream scores, like the one for Thief and
Sorcerer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
Oh, yeah.
Or even Lalo Schifrin's scores. I mean, he's still around, and it apparently for to get him to do the score for Rush Hour, that was like a fight with studio executives for Brett Ratner, because they were like, "No, it's old style. We don't want that."
And
he had to fight.
Like,
he had to fight to get Lalo Schifrin to do the score.
Brett Ratner is.
Yeah, no, I was going to say it's a fight because I don't want to have Lalo's name tarnished by being on a Brett Ratner film. That's for sure.
Right. And then Schifrin did the score for some Bigfoot thriller just because the director was like his nephew or something, or was like a relative.
And he did the Amityville Horror as well, the original from 79.
Yeah.
Which is
The Big
cool.
Brawl with Jackie Chan is a good score that he did.
Oh, okay. He did that one.
Yeah. He did a lot of cool scores, but he has a rejected Exorcist score that William Friedkin claims he threw the master tape into a sewer or something. it has popped up on YouTube, so it's like that's another Friedkin tall.
That still blows my mind, that Exorcist score by Mike Oldfield.
Yeah.
He was fucking 19 when he did that. That is insane.
But it wasn't intended to be the score. It was just
that
album.
But that 19-year-old kid can produce that is just fucking crazy.
Yeah, well, I think there was different talent back then. I think it was just people were on a higher plane of maturity or something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And don't even start.
I'm not sure what it is, but you look at some of the famous roles we know of and stuff, and it's like those actors are like in their 20s. And, of course, now to our eyes today, they look like they were in their 30s or 40s.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had to grow up quicker back then. Nobody was collecting Star Wars toys. So, you know.
John Jolly Hammer.
They were aging into their roles.
Star Wars toys.
Yeah, I just don't get it. I don't quite understand it.
So. Oh, Hunter and I have a mutual friends who do collect them, and, you know, they're friends of ours. So, yeah, I'm not going to knock it. It's,
I have friends who do the same thing, but I've even told them, I go, I don't get it. You know, I think you guys are just going to see these things to collect toys. I think you're just going to these movies to do that and forcing these movies on your kids.
I wonder if they ever made, like, Dirty Harry toys.
I thought McFarlane's company did come out with a figure.
I'm sure they did. Todd McFarlane's always doing stuff like that.
Like a Scorpio doll.
He put out all sorts of...
Yeah.
Oh, wouldn't that be crazy?
That would be very cool.
I would like a Harry Gardino figure. I think it'd be great. Hey, Harry, take it easy. Yeah, it's the mayor you're talking to, Harry.
Damn it all, Harry, it's the mayor you're talking to.
Yeah, Bradford Dillman.
Yeah.
You know, like, what I loved about the Dirty Harry series is those actors were in every one of them in the same roles.
Oh, get an Albert Popwell doll as well.
Yeah, except he plays, like, he plays four different characters in the series.
It's like, collect all four Albert Popwell dolls, the pimp from Magnum Force, the Mustafa from The Enforcer, and the bank robber from Dirty Harry. And who was he in Sudden Impact? Yeah, Sudden Impact, he's his mate who's just shooting out in the woods.
He was, yeah,
that's right,
he was
yes.
Police part.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's right. He was his partner, his doomed partner. And it's funny because Fargo said that Eastwood liked using Popwell and some other familiar faces because he liked actors who were no trouble on the set.
Yeah.
Popwell was just one of those guys who came to work, did his lines, did them great, and went home, you know, and that's what he liked. Because it's a job.
That's it. Hi, Jackie. What's some other films that you guys have seen lately of Eastwood's? Let's say in the 2000s anyway, that you really enjoyed, whether he's been in it or behind the camera.
I liked American Sniper.
Okay, I've still not seen that.
I like Gran Torino a lot.
Yeah, Gran Torino is great. Maybe we should do that on the show.
I need to find it. Is it out on Blu-ray or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's recent. I haven't seen American Sniper. I don't think I've seen many. I saw one of his Flags of Our Fathers or whatever. It was okay, but nothing.
I missed that one. I liked Sands of Iwo Jima, all right.
I'll tell you the one I enjoyed the most. I mean, I've not seen a lot of those, so I really can't say, but the one I have seen I really enjoyed was Jersey Boys. I thought it was fantastic.
Oh, I missed that.
I really liked Jersey Boys. I did see that. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
One that I liked okay was Mystic River.
I haven't seen it.
No, I've not seen it. I know, my dad went on and on about how much he enjoyed Mystic River.
It uses John Carpenter's vampires in a scene.
Yeah, he's got Sean Penn, right?
Sean Penn and Tim Robbins and Kevin Bacon.
Yeah,
I know.
It's Sean Penn. It's just
I know that's like a groan, but it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah,
I think I read the book and did not like the book, so I just never saw the movie.
Well, we should do Gran Torino on the show.
Okay, sure. Gives me an excuse to track it down and pick it up. I've just never.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't seen that one, Stu. I think you'd love it.
Yeah.
Oh, probably would, yeah. If it's just Clint, you know, being Clint.
It's definitely like, I think it's kind of like Unforgiven was supposed to be like his epitaph to Westerns. This is sort of his epitaph to Dirty Harry a little bit.
Yeah. This is sort of like the Dirty Harry retirement movie we never actually
saw. Can we replace the Deadpool with Gran Torino then? In our minds,
I think
at least?
Yeah, we don't need to do the Deadpool.
No. Oh, we don't? With Liam Neeson and Jim Carrey?
Yeah.
Guns and Roses?
Oh, please. Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up. I forgot to do this at the top of the show. Go to MidnightMovieCowboys.com and click the PayPal button if you want to donate. Give us some donations. And if you can't do that, if you want to support us another way, go to iTunes. Leave us a rating and review because that also helps us out in a big way and it doesn't cost you anything.
Do one or the other because if you don't, there'll be the last thing you'll see will be the letters RWDS.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'll be RWDS time. So, you know, be sure to do that. Otherwise, you know, we can't be responsible for what happens.
That's right.
Yeah. John, do you have anything you need to plug?
No, not this week.
Not this week? Okay. I don't think I have anything else to plug. I do want to have Paul Joseph Watson review Alien 3 at some point.
Okay. If he's so inclined.
Well, you know, I'll talk to Paul and see if it can happen, you know. But no, you know, I don't know when, you know, he's got to work on it. So
I think his review of the terrible Alien 3 will actually be longer than what the film is at nearly 2 hours.
I don't know. Paul Joseph Watson's pretty concise. I think he can keep it short, you know.
Yeah, but there's a lot of questions as well about that film that need to be asked.
Yeah, there are. There are. Well, you know, he will ask those questions, and I think he'll give us answers, you know.
Very good.
Like he gave us answers about this podcast.
That's right.
I so hate that film. I really hate that film.
I don't know about hate it. I thought, boy, this is it's just not good. And there's a lot of studio meddling, you can tell.
Oh, and I saw it in theater, and you have to remember it was following up Aliens, and everybody was hyped up to see it because the ads implied it was Alien on Earth. And which it was not. Then I read this article in Cinefantastique that was literally saying skip the movie. Like, yeah. Just don't go see it. It's going to be terrible. And it was. And I read about its development. The development hell on that movie was insane.
Yeah.
Like, how I that mean, ended
the
up
the original
being
trailer
prison.
Said it was going to be on Earth. It was like, oh, now everyone can hear you scream on Earth.
And because they hadn't even shot a foot of film or approved a script, I think they were still thinking of going with the William Gibson screenplay they had, which was
and there was the Vincent Ward one too, where
right
the
Vincent Ward one is the one that really developed into the prison
yeah.
planet
because it was supposed to be the monk wood planet one,
right it was supposed to be monks and a monastery and developing like all these, they had developed like these medieval weapons to defeat the alien threat. So
on a final note, after I watched Alien 3, I watched a little bit of the making of, and you could see Fincher's face. Like, he looks really happy, and then in other shots, he looks miserable as fuck. He's like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
This guy can have a good time. Yeah.
I think Lance Henriksen said in an interview, like, Fincher was going through hell on that set. It's like, yeah. The kid's got talent, but the studio execs were putting him through hell. You know, so it was kind of...
Yeah, when they did the special edition DVD, like, you know, they did one for Alien, and... You know, Ridley Scott was involved and he had a new director's cut, and then they had Aliens and it had James Cameron involved, and they did Alien Resurrection and Jean-Pierre Jeunet was involved and he had an alternate cut, and then the Alien 3 one, Fincher was nowhere to be seen. Nope. And they just had Terry Rawlings put together the assembly cut for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he ran a New Line Cinema to work for them. He wasn't... He did not want to deal with Fox for a while.
Yeah.
And I looked at a little bit of Alien Resurrection, and the only thing I could take away from that actually looked appealing was, or you know, remotely interesting, was that Sigourney Weaver looked like Glenn Danzig a lot in that film.
Yeah. Dude, Alien Resurrection's a piece of shit.
I've heard across the board it's just horrible, and it's almost
entertaining to watch, though. It's so bad. Like, I can watch that movie anytime because it's just so freaking weird and just off the wall and stupid.
Although Winona Ryder looked hot as in it, but then she always does. In my eyes.
I heard she steals a lot of scenes.
She was supposed to,
you know.
But then that movie was the problem with the Alien movies is they're made by executives, and Cameron was able to make a good movie because he was making it so cheap. They didn't really pay attention to him as much.
Yeah.
And he was able to make a more satisfying movie. And then Alien 3, they were so eager to have Sigourney Weaver in the film. They didn't need her. I mean, nobody cares about her. They want to see the monsters. It's
yeah.
just, you know, it's just like they built the whole thing around her, and then they made Alien 3 like this big stupid abortion allegory, which is like, it's so obvious and annoying. It's just, man, it's a bad film.
Yeah.
But I remember the Gore Gazette was saying that all the prison inmates look like the staff of the Village Voice. I never forgot that.
That's fucking funny.
If Winona Ryder is so hot, why does Mel Gibson call her an oven dodger?
Oh, God.
Well, he did do that, according to her. She claims... He said that.
She's a whack job, though.
Yeah, no, she totally is. She's klepto.
She's always been like this whack job.
That's why I said she steals scenes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. She does steal scenes and purses.
And purses.
Gucci handbags.
And a lot of security tags to go with it.
All right, let's wrap it up, I think. I think that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, I'm just going to go ahead and say adios.
I'll say marvelous, Magadog.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com.
and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com, type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.